Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
Yeah, that's actually from a movie called The Bachelor that came out the year before the TV show came out. And I don't know. I don't know if that one whole thing would actually work in real life or not. What do you think? I don't know. It's interesting, though. He kind of pulls out a lot of the ideas we have about marriage. At the end, he comes back to it. He just says, you know, can't we just leave things the way they are? And it's amazing how I'm kind of out there in the world now and just looking to see marriage firsthand. It's amazing how pessimistic singles are about the idea of marriage, especially when you get to be my age. I'm told more and more that I'm no longer young. I'm getting old. Especially when you realize that most of the dating pool you're out there with has already tried marriage at least once. And they've been there. They've done that. And so the view on marriage is kind of like, yeah, I'm not really sure I want to do this again. And after all, 50% of all marriages end in divorce. And so why? I mean, I've already been there, done that. And sure enough, I lost the coin flip the first time. And you would think, well, hey, if I lost the first time, maybe the second time will be the charm, right? Because, you know, first time died, next time will work. But the statistics, you know, that are out there show that your second marriage has a 65% chance or worse at lasting. And so I'm looking at it now, almost 40, thinking, so you're telling me that if I decide to get married, I've got about a 35% chance or so of this thing actually working out. I don't know about you, but I'm not really excited about that. I mean, if I were to tell you, I want you to take all of your life savings and invest all of it in investment that has a 35% chance of succeeding, otherwise it's going to, you know, blow up in your face, you lose everything. You in? No. Well, here's the thing. This whole series is called Family Lies. Those statistics that I just shared with you are quite popular, quite commonly told, quite commonly cited, but they're not true. They're not true. As a matter of fact, the idea that 50% of all marriages end in divorce has never been shown in a statistical study. Yet it's quoted over and over and over and over and over again. And a couple years back, by the way, thank you 700 Club for pointing this out. I actually saw one of their series on this. There's a lady who was doing a research. She was actually writing an article. A newspaper reporter writing an article, and she was on marriage. So she went to quote the 50-50 statistic. She had her research assistant just go, hey, I'm having a hard time finding out where the statistic had come from. Could you just look this up? So goes, he starts looking it up, and he comes back, and he's like, it's going to take a little while. Like, what do you mean it's going to take a little while? Everybody quotes this. Who are they quoting? They went and they tracked down the source, and they asked, well, where are you getting this from? Oh, we got it from this group. Well, that's that group. Where did you get it from? Oh, well, we just didn't really source it. It was a dead end. So they went to another. Finally, here's what she found out. Back in the late 70s, when they went to no-fault divorce, where you could divorce for any reason whatsoever, divorce just skyrocketed, right? A whole bunch of people just ran out to get a divorce. Sociologists came in and predicted what the divorce rate would be given the way they'd been the past couple of years over what it would be like in the 80s. So they predicted a 50-50 divorce rate, which, by the way, never happened. Never went that way. As a matter of fact, divorce rates from the 70s when they had that open divorce law have gone down every year since. The trend has always been going down. It has never reached 50-50. There was, though, one study that did show a 50-50 chance at marriage. But it wasn't a study that was originally trying to target marriages and the success rate of marriage. It was actually a study on teen pregnancy. And they were interviewing teen pregnancy situations. And believe it or not, you may not realize this, but actually, if you are in your teenage years, between the age of 14 and 19, and you have a baby and then get married, there is actually a higher percentage chance of you getting a divorce and that marriage not working out than if you wait till your 20s and wait to have kids. I know that's shocking to a lot of you, I know, but believe it or not, getting married in your teenage years, you don't always know what you're doing. You don't really know what you're getting into, and adding a baby to the whole mix actually adds a lot of stress. You may not realize that. It's reading this stuff reminded me of a report years ago that found that the readers of Cat Fancy magazine are much more likely than the average person to own a cat. That was actually a study somebody did. I'm like, what is that, like the bonehead in the stats class that just says, I'm going to do a study that I already know the answer to? I mean, really. So they go and they do this study and they interview pregnant teen moms about their marriages, and they follow up with them 10 years later, and what do you know? That study showed 50-50 shot. didn't take anybody else into consideration. That's the only study that's ever been statistically shown that number out. Now, considering that the average age people get married in America now is between the age 25 and 27, how valid is that stat? As a matter of fact, even if you take the worst statistical analysis studies, marriage in this country has never been, has never shown to be more than 35% failure rate. Most studies are putting it somewhere around 27%. In other words, it's not a 50-50. It's a better than 75% chance. Now, the other interesting thing that came out in there was she actually called up George Barna, because if you've studied this thing at all, I remember hearing this years ago back in my seminary days, and I've actually, to my own shame, taught this. Barna did a study a while back confirming that there is little to no difference whatsoever between a Christian marriage and a non-Christian marriage when it comes to the divorce rate. However, when we went back and looked at his methodology and the question he asked, he just simply asked, are you a Christian, and then asked about their marriage. They went back and did another study, though, where they asked, did you go to church last Sunday? And the person answered yes, and they asked about the marriage. And they answered no, and they asked about the marriage. And on that study, surprisingly, or I should say not surprisingly, they found that there was a significant difference between a Christian marriage. I think the numbers there were like only 8 to 15% ended in divorce. Interesting. Compared to, and even the other ones were still in the 25 to 30% range. I found that very interesting. Now, to me, it's a lie. It's a lie we've been told, a lie we believe. And I learned a very fancy word in the Truth Project that we've been doing with our small groups, something called a pernicious lie. And one of the guys in our group actually looked up the word pernicious, because believe it or not, none of us in the room actually knew what the word pernicious meant. I'm sure all of you all know what pernicious means and use it in your everyday language. But pernicious, just for the rest of you, for one of you who don't know that word, it actually is a word which means a very subtle lie which causes great destructive harm. And that's what this 50-50 false stat is. We just believe it. Oh, yeah, 50-50. Oh, right. We don't really think anything of it. We just accept it as fact. And when you accept it as fact, what it does is it results in two things. One, it makes single people not want anything to do with it. Why on earth should I get married if it's a 50-50 coin flip? Oh, it's my second marriage. It's going to be somebody else's second marriage. Oh, it's even worse. Why would I want to do that? I'll just stay single, thank you. I'll just, you know, find some other method around this whole thing. Because it just seems like a bad idea and a bad investment, a bad idea because it's just not going to work out. Why would I possibly enter into a relationship which only has about a 35 to 50% chance at best at working out? Forget it. No, thank you. And then for those who are married, they look at it. When they hit a rough spot, they go, well, bound to happen. Coin flip. I mean, two of us got together. It was, one of us was going to get divorced, right? 50-50. I don't know. So we look at it and say, you know, what's the point of even trying? Because everybody ends up like this. We're just like everybody else. We're no different. Well, would it change your mind at all if when you hit that rough patch, if you somebody came in and said, you know, this wasn't ever a 50-50 thing. You're about to go where only 25% of marriages go if you go through with this decision to end this thing. On top of that, let me tell you another stat. Over 65% of marriages who stick it out at the point that you're at right now, if they just give it another couple years, over 65% of the time, they come out and say they have a happy marriage. They're really glad they stayed. Would that change at all how you view your current state? I think it would for me. And so going back to see what Scripture was all about, when you go back and you look and see what it was that God designed in the first place, I think we see some things that open our eyes, which it's important to know that marriage was not our idea. Marriage wasn't like two cavemen sat in a room and, you know, oh, she looked good, came back. I don't know. Maybe they spoke English. I don't know how to grunt like a caveman. But it wasn't two cave people that came together and said, let's give this thing a shot. And then later on realized, you know, that was kind of a dumb idea. It didn't really work out. No, it wasn't two people who thought they'd give us a shot and now statistically found it's not really working out so well, so let's just abandon it. No, this was God's idea. It was God who thought up the whole concept of marriage. And when Paul is writing in Ephesians chapter 5 and he's talking about marriage, he goes back and quotes the most ancient source on marriage and attributes it back to God. That's Genesis chapter 2, verse 25. That's where that verse where this reason a man shall leave his father and mother to cleave to his wife. And so let's see what he says about marriage. And ultimately, he's going to ground it in the fact that this was God's idea. And here's his instruction teaching on marriage. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, to make her holy and cleansing her by the washing of the water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any blemish, but holy and blameless. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as they love their own bodies. For he who loves his wife loves himself. After all, nobody ever hated their own body, but they feed and care for the body just as Christ does the church. For we are members of his body, and for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be united with his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery. By the way, I've seen that verse quoted as some people's life verse for their marriage. The whole thing's a mystery to me, man. It's what the Word of God says, Ephesians 5:32. I don't understand it. The whole thing's a mystery. But in context, this is a profound mystery, this whole connection between Christ and the church and husband and wife. He says, of course, I'm talking about Christ and the church. Each one of you must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. Now, in the King James, many of y'all know this verse where it says the husband shall cleave to his wife. Here in the NIV, it says unite. And if you go back into the Hebrew, it's actually a technical legal term that's used to describe a covenant. It's not just talking about two people who are kind of bonded together. This is actual covenantal language. This is legalistic language here for this cleaving. And it's bringing into the idea, listen, marriage was never about two people just having a good time and giving it a shot. It was a covenant. It's where you're saying, listen, I'm in this for life. From this day forward, I'm going to do this. We're in it for life. And if you think about the marriage ceremony and the way the whole thing works out, it all reflects the fact that this is a covenant. I mean, to begin with, I've actually had this thought and played out this scenario. It kind of occurred to me. I'm now single again. I'm a pastor. And I'm licensed in the state of Virginia to do weddings and marriages. I was kind of like, I wonder if it's possible for me to marry myself. I mean, why not? I'm licensed to do it. I'm legally allowed. I wonder if I'm legally allowed to marry myself. Like just sitting there at Red Lobster. And if the mood is right, why don't we get married? Why don't we do it right now? I can do this. And just get married. And when I say get married to myself, I don't mean like married. Get married to myself. I mean like marry somebody else and me preside over it. I could say, do you? And I say, yeah, I do. And then I could say, you do. And we could do all that. And then I could do the vows. I wouldn't have to repeat after me. I could just say them. And then I could ask her to repeat after me. And I could make it whatever I wanted. I've actually messed up the marriage vows and had people repeat stuff like, and your problems will be your problems. I actually said that in... accidentally, and the person repeated it, and it's this running joke I have with this couple now, 15 years later. I just remember, now remember, you promised that her problems will be your problems, but she only promised that your problems will be your problems. That was a part of your vow that they repeated, because they just mindlessly repeat a lot of times. But you can't do that. You can't just preside over your own marriage, because it's a covenant. It's a unique thing, and when you're having a covenant, you're making it before some other entity that can call you into account. And so you do it before, you invite your friends and your family, and you have a pastor or some representative of the government there with you. And what you're saying is this: I'm going to promise from this day forward to do this. This is what I'm promising. And I'm inviting you into this. And I want you to hold me accountable if I don't do this. So years later, when things are going bad and you want to hit the eject button and run out of this, and somebody comes into your life and says, I don't want to talk to you about this. And they say, whoa, this is none of your business. Then what did you invite me to the wedding for? You invited me in on this whole thing. I bought that ugly dress and stood up there with you. I've never worn it again. Who in their right mind would wear that thing anywhere else? I didn't wear it because I liked the dress. I wore it because you invited me in to witness and be a part of this. And you've invited the accountability that comes with it. This wasn't just a dating relationship where you made some promises over Red Lobster. No, no, no. You brought everybody in and said, here's what we're going to do. And you've invited in that accountability from your friends and from your family. And if you, of course, in the state of Virginia is also going to hold you accountable to that. And if you have a pastor come in there, now you're asking God to hold you accountable for that. I always tell couples, I don't have any pixie dust. I can't reach back in a little thing and sprinkle it over and make God all approve it. No, you got to be doing the things to put yourself in a position to be blessed by God. But the reason why you have a pastor is because you're saying, I want God to enforce this marriage covenant. I want him to stand witness over this and let him know he has the ultimate right to call me into account on this. And I'm not just going to be bound by the laws of the state of Virginia, but I'm going to be bound by the laws of God on how I conduct myself and what I do in this. And so I ask him, are you sure you want me to do this? I recommend if you listen, don't bring God into this unless you have to. Seriously, it's a whole lot easier to do marriage the world way and let it go down there because it gives you a whole lot more outs, gives you a whole lot more options down the road. I can't tell you God will bless it or not, but if you want God to be a part of this, that he's got a higher standard. So if we're going to do this whole covenant thing, we're going to invite God to be a part of this, invite your friends and family to be a part of this, just know you're asking them and calling them to have the opportunity and the right to call you into account for this. So that's what a covenant is, where you're calling people in to be accountable to. and watch over it. And the other thing we do in a wedding ceremony, if you look at the way they work out, it doesn't matter who does it. Almost every wedding ceremony is very similar. The first part of the wedding ceremony is I'm asking questions as the pastor. I'm asking the questions, will you? And these are the I do questions. And when they're doing this, the couple standing side by side and they're facing me. And they're not answering, they're not just telling me. I'm just God's ambassador. I'm just here on his behalf. I'm his voice piece asking these questions on his behalf because he doesn't really speak in very audible voices very often anymore. You know what I'm saying? So I'm there actually doing the talking and asking, will you do this? And they say, I do. So they're telling God, this is what I'm going to do, God. I'm going to take them as my lawfully wedded wife, to have and to hold, to love, honor, and cherish, as long as we both shall live. God, that's what I'm going to do. And then I have them turn to each other, make promises to each other. And that's where the vows come in. I take you to be my lawfully wedded wife. From this day forward, for better, for worse, richer, for poor. And what we're doing on that moment, we know it's a covenant because we're not talking about where we're at now. We're talking about where we will be and what we will do. It's a future promise. It's saying, regardless of what happens, here's what you can count on. You can count on me. Sickness and health, rich or poor, doesn't matter. For better or for worse, whatever happens, whatever comes away, you just got to know this one thing. You can bank on this. I'll be here. It's a promise. It's a covenant. It's a commitment. And it's very different than a dating relationship. I mean, when you and your girlfriend, you and your boyfriend break up, your parents don't have any right to come in. Why'd you break up? He was a good young man. You should have known. Whoa. I didn't invite you to be a part of this. I didn't call you up and have you witness the time that we decide to be boyfriend and girlfriend. I'm not asking you to hold me accountable to this relationship. I can get in out of whatever I want. Very, very different. So why? Why does God insist in this cleaving? Why is the cleaving in the covenant part, why is that essential to the core of marriage? Well, it's got to be there because, as we said last week, marriage is going to bring out the worst in you. It will literally bring out the worst in you, which is why most people say, well, then what's the point? Why would I get myself in a relationship that's going to bring out the worst in me? Why? Because the worst needs to get out of you. It needs to come to the surface. It can't stay there. God doesn't want it to stay there, okay? And here's the thing. Every other relationship that you have doesn't have the same level of commitment, so it is not going to squeeze out of you all of the junk that needs to come out of you. And you know this to be true. You've got people you work with that you will never hang out with outside of work, right? Because your commitment to that person is limited to financial success, right? And once we're done with work, it's great. You have a great weekend, man. I got plans. I got plans doing the thing with the people and the stuff. I'll see you on Monday. I'll see you Tuesday. I'll see you then. Because you want nothing to do with them outside of work. You got people you play softball with, and they're great on your softball team because they can just hammer and homer and all that kind of good stuff. I mean, they're amazing. But after softball's over, I don't really want to hang out with them. And you got other friends. They're great friends or great buddies, but you would never hire them. You never want to work alongside them. You limit your commitments in different areas with people because there's issues. You see them, but you don't bring it up. Why? Ain't my place. Not my place to do so. It's there. They got an issue. They got a problem. I'm not really going to jump in on that. That's just kind of their thing. But when it comes to the marriage relationship, you look at somebody straight in the face and say, listen, I've committed myself to you for life. And I'm not doing this for life. You're not doing this for life. No. That's got to go. I already told you I'm not going to go, so that's got to go. And you need to choose, you want me or you want that? Because that's what it's going to come down to. At the end of the day, that stuff and me are not compatible. I'm not going to leave, but that's got to go. And you see that reflected in here. This is the whole context of this. He says, Christ gave himself up for why? To make her holy. Cleansing by the washing of the word, or washing of water with the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church, without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. What is that? That's taking all the imperfection and getting it out. The purpose of marriage in the covenant context is to make you more like Christ and take everything that doesn't need to be there, shouldn't be there, isn't a part of the image that God wants for you to be and to become. He doesn't want that in your life anymore, and marriage is the perfect opportunity and context to get it out, but it's got to be a covenant commitment. Because if you're not committed to it, it's not going to be worth your time. Mama might see your flaws, but she's not committed to you like that. She's done with you. You're out of the house. It doesn't bug her every day. She's white. You know, she's probably rose-colored glasses the whole thing anyway. The reason why you see it and Mama doesn't is you have to live with it every day. And so, yeah, I'm not surprised you're. And people say, well, nobody else has a problem with this. Well, nobody else knows you like I know you. And nobody else is impacted by this like I'm impacted by this. this is me. This is my life. And I'm not going to do this. This has got to change. You have that opportunity within the context of a marriage relationship. When we read this kind of passage in here and you read about, marriage is all about washing with water. You're like, that sounds like a reason to get married right there. We're just going to wash each other and clean each other up. That's kind of something I'm looking forward to in the whole marriage process. But that's not exactly how this works out. Don't think of that. Think of something else that goes with the marriage. More like when you make that first sort of commitment promise and you say something very romantic like you win, it's usually accompanied by a stone. Could be a diamond, emerald, ruby, whatever it may be, a very precious stone. And that stone, as it's presented on that day, is beautiful. It's been refined. It's been cleaned up. It's been polished. But if you saw that diamond years ago, when it first came out of the ground, it didn't look anything like that. What's happened, though, is an expert who knows that rock intimately and has studied that rock and spent much time investigating and looking into it, because there's a lot at stake with what he does with that. And they've looked at it so thoroughly, they figured out exactly what it is on that rock that needs to go. And so they begin to make cuts and cuts, and they examine again and make more cuts, and examine again and make more cuts and more cuts and more cuts. And then once they get it cut down to the shape they want, they actually subject it to an amazing heat and pressure and polish to get every last remaining of any impurity they possibly can, to get all the impurities possible out of that stone completely. And now they even have new ways where they can actually take and they can inject stuff into the stone. They call them clarity enhanced, where they take even the flaws that still remain that they can't get any other way, and they actually do something else to make them invisible to the eye. So you can present it there on that engagement day for that wedding day. And it's such a great picture of that one day when you're before Christ and you're up there with him in heaven. That's your wedding day with God himself. And the whole point of the marriage is just like in that gym lab, where the marriage is there cutting away and shaking away and polishing away and subjecting to the heat. So one day when you're presented to Christ is that engagement day of that wedding. That it says in here that you're without stain or wrinkle or blemish. Beautiful, holy, and blameless. You are a color. You are a flawless diamond, which is very rare and very, very expensive. God says, that's what I want. That's how I see you. When Michelangelo was asked about his sculpture, David, which is one of those ones you always see in the cartoons and everywhere else, he was asked how it was that he created David out of this marble slab. And he says, well, I simply began with a good slab, and I took away everything in it that was not David. And that's such a beautiful picture of marriage. You need to do is not look for your David. You need to look for a good slab. Get a chisel in the hand and start taking away everything that is not Christ. When you get married, you're handing somebody a hammer and a chisel. They have at it. Because I want to be more like Christ. I want to be blameless and without fault one day. I want to be as good as I possibly can to present myself to him on that day. Say, here I am. And the only way I'm going to get there is if I give you this hammer and give you this chisel and give you free reign and free right to have at me. And it's not an easy process. As I chip away and as I chip away, there's things that you don't want to let go of. There's things that you don't want to do. But when somebody says, I do, and they walk into that process, what they're doing is this. They're basically saying, listen, I see in you Christ. I can see it. I can see what God's hopes for you. I can see the person that God wants you to be. I can see the person that he's working and shaping you in. And if we just get rid of this and we just do this, you'll be like Christ. And I want you to be more like Christ. And I picture the scene in heaven with God pulling you in with your marriage partner from life or however many there were, and lining them all up. And at that moment, then being able to look at you, and what you hear them saying is, I always knew you'd look this good. I always saw it. Here you are. And, like as if God takes the precious gem that you are with everything that marriage has done to shape you more like him. He just puts you the finishing touch. He finally does that final clarity enhancement where he makes you just like his son Jesus Christ. Allows you to reflect back his image. And the rest of the world may not see it. but you need to see it. You need to see it in them. You need to be humble enough to give them the hammer and the chisel and say, have at it. Which goes to the last part of this. The whole thing with covenant is not about what I can expect out of you, but it's what I expect, what's expected out of me. And one little subtle thing in this passage you got to notice is the tendency in this message and last week's message and probably all the messages in the series, this is one of those elbow messages, right? This is one of those, hey, you need to listen to this message. This is one of those, let me send you the link. Let me get this down on a CD so I can send it to you. Hey, you need to go back and re-listen to this. Hey, did you hear what the pastor said? He was talking about you, you know? This is one of those kind of messages. But note very clearly, the passage does not read like this. Okay, now wives, make sure your husband loves you. Remember how Christ loved the church? He needs to be doing that for you. Remember how he was making her holy? Well, he needs to be making you holy. He needs to be cleansing you by the water through the word. He needs to be pulling out scripture and saying, this is what scripture says, this is what I see. And he needs to be that spiritual leader. That's what he needs to be doing. You need to tell him that's what he's got to be doing. In the same way, wives, make sure your husbands love you just like they love their own bodies. You know how much they love their body and groom themselves? Well, they need to be loving you on the same way and buying you all the stuff that you need to do to make you look like you want to look. You need to be doing all that stuff. Wives, make sure he loves you just like he loves others. And husbands, you better make sure she respects you. Mm-hmm. That's what the word says, isn't it, John? That's what it says. Or does it? As I read it, when he addresses the part to husbands, who's he talking to? Are you talking to the wives? Talking to the wives, say, wives, make sure your husband's doing this? No. He says, husbands, here's what I have for you. You need to hear this message. You need to hear this. Wives, here's the message you need to hear. I didn't even put the whole wives submit to your husbands. We've got such a corrupted view of what that passage means. I didn't even go there to this morning. Some of you are like, whoa, you left that out. Let her figure that out. God wasn't asking you to point that out. Last week we talked about how we need to submit to one another. Why don't we start there? Covenant begins with me. Back when a few weeks ago I did a series on called Life Sucks Everything Out of You. And in there I was talking about how sexual relationships and how sexual relationships, sex is meant to be an expression of the relationship. And it does quite actually a really good job of expressing our view of marriage. Now, sex was intended to be an expression of the covenant relationship between a man and woman, where they've given themselves completely and totally to the other person. And sex is just a physical representation of the emotional and spiritual bond that those two people have. However, in our society, we've made sex into a consumer good. It's nothing more than consumer good. It's so much so that the porn industry in America makes more money than the NFL, the NBA, the NHL. I don't think they make much money anyway, so they just add on the list. WNBA, they don't make much money. MLS, you know, soccer. They add all of them in there together. Every major league sports franchise combined, everyone combined, does not make as much as the porn industry makes in America every year. Sex is a consumer good. That's only because it's a reflection of how we view relationships. Because we view marriage relationships as a consumer good, not a covenant good. What I mean by that is this. In a consumer relationship, it's all about, I give you this and you give me this. And as long as you're giving me in return something that's of value compared to what I'm giving you, I'm okay. And there's even times where you're willing to pay more simply because there's an added value or bonus to that in some way, shape, or form. Because you have a relationship, because you have a rapport. But over time, if you're failing to get the return on investment that you should, eventually that relationship will end. In the same way, if revenues from any business stream are down, eventually you've got to cut expenses. And the way this works out in relational capital is simply this. We begin to look at it and say, I just feel like I'm putting more in than what I'm getting out. I just feel like as if I'm investing a whole lot more time and energy than I'm ever getting back for this. I feel like I give and I give and I give and they give nothing in return. So what's the point? After all, 50% of marriages end in divorce, and I guess this was just destined to happen. It's a consumer good. And we look at other cultures that make marriage into a blatant consumer good, where they actually ask the husband's family to purchase the daughter from the parents of the bride. We go, oh, that's horrible. That's we don't do anything like that. Yet we'll say, hey, did you hear Cindy's back on the market? Man, she really lucked out with him, didn't she? Wow. How did he ever get her to say yes? He must have gave a big diamond. How big was the diamond that he had to give her to get her to say yes? Actually, there was actually an advertisement I saw recently that says, make sure she says yes. And it was this diamond store. And I'm like, really? Really? I mean, you got to buy her off with a rock. I mean, she would never say yes to you otherwise. But let her say yes to the rock because she's not going to say yes to you. Just buy her affection, right? And by the way, you start there, you will go there the rest of your life. Or vice versa. And so we make marriage into a consumer good. And at some point when we're not getting back what we feel is value, we start pulling back. And when we start pulling back, you know what they do? They start pulling back. And over time, you got two people who just keep pulling back and pulling back. But here's the thing. In America, we're okay with it. Nobody's going to chastise you for treating your marriage as a consumer good. Matter of fact, you go to the hairdresser, you go to the bartender, they'll encourage it. Yeah, man. You know, you got to do what makes you feel good. You got to do what's right for you. Tell you, if they're not giving back, then you need to limit. You need to protect yourself. That's what we hear all the time. Nobody's going to yell at you on Dr. Phil if you act like that. They're actually going to probably be like, that's good. You need to stand up for yourself. However, in America, we're very fiercely defending the parent-child relationship as a covenant relationship. You try to treat a parent-child relationship like a consumer good, oh, you'll be on Dr. Phil. You'll just be yelled at by him and all the masses, right? Everybody in the audience is going to throw a stone at you for that. Because in a parent-child relationship, we instinctively know, even in our secular culture, that has to be a covenant relationship, where you give and you give and you give without asking, what do I get in return? If you have the opportunity to be a parent, you will find that the most selfish, needy person you will ever meet is that kid. They will demand and demand and demand and demand of you. I mean, just the other night, Jackson comes into my room. He couldn't sleep, whatever, wanted to come in. And I don't know what dark 30 time it was, but I just know that by the time I finally was thinking to myself, the alarm should be going off any minute, it was almost 5 o'clock. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. I thought for sure it was like 6 a.m. when he came in here. No, it was somewhere in the 4 o'clock hour-ish. And kept me up all night. And finally, I was like, dude, I have cuddled you and comforted you as long as I possibly can. Daddy needs sleep. I'm rolling over. And I don't know whether he left at that point. I don't know. I was out. But, you know, the cool thing about it was the next morning, I woke up, came downstairs. He had already made breakfast for himself, his brothers and sisters. He cleaned up his room and he made me a card and said, Dad, thanks for last night. You filled my emotional love tank and I love you. Yes, I am lying. Seriously? You really think? Really? Really? My gosh! You guys are more romantic, you know, sucked up into all this. Come on. If you're a parent and you believe that, shame on you. All the people who never had kids say, wow, that sounds good. You parents were like, I'm calling you out on that one. No way. You know, he didn't even thank me. He just asked me if I'd made his lunch yet. Took it and ran out the door. That was it. Never heard another word about it. And then later that day when I told him Daddy was tired, Daddy needs to take a nap, you think he was like, oh yeah, you were up with me late last night. I'm sorry. You go ahead and do that. I'll watch the brother and sister for you. It was, oh, Dad, it's a great day out. Aren't you playing with? And on it goes. If it was a consumer-based relationship, am I getting out of that what I'm putting into it? No. I remember my dad had a picture. He gave me the Porsche dealer. My dad was a doctor, so the Porsche dealer sends him a poster where they had printed on the poster. This is how cool it is as a kid. I have a Porsche poster. It has Swisher, the last name, on the custom license plate on the poster because they're trying to get doctors to buy a Porsche. So my dad takes it and he gives it to me. I'm like, wow, Dad. When are you going to get me one of those? He says, I got you instead. And I say, what do you mean? He says, you cost more than that thing. I said, no, I don't. And he says, you want to do the math? I could have bought two of those instead of you. But then he said, I'm happy with my choice. And that poster was always on my wall. Every time I looked at it and coveted it, wanted it, jealous after it, I was reminded that my dad chose me instead of that car. Because I'd pull into the doctor parking lot and there's all these nice cars, and my dad drove a Honda Accord. And every time I saw those Porsches, I thought to myself, Dad chose me over those cars. That was worth it to him. And so you go, and the kids grow up, and they go through the rebellious teenage years, and you get even less and less. There's even times where you got to bail them out throughout life. But here's the thing. So often, this is what happens. After 18 years of treating the marriage like a consumer relationship and treating the children like a covenant relationship, you have this enduring, loving bond with the kids, and you call it quits with the spouse. Should we be surprised? Should we be surprised? But when studies show you treat the marriage like a covenant relationship and you do the actions of love without worrying about the feelings, studies consistently show the feelings come. The feelings come back. Just in the same way they come back with the kids. Do all y'all feel like loving your kids? You base your love on your kids for a feeling you have? No, you do it because they're your kids. But then I say, do it to your husband. Whoa, hey, you don't know who I'm married to. Go on Dr. Phil and say, hey, you want me to love my kids? You don't know my kid. Let me tell you some stories. And everybody in the audience will be reaching down, picking up the rock that's underneath their seat, right? That's the way those shows work. So let me ask you, are you looking at yourself right now, looking at the way you're treating your relationships? Are you able to see in them the image that God created them to be? Are you humble enough to hand them the hammer and the chisel and say, have at it? I want to be more like Christ and I will do whatever it takes. My life's open to you. I don't want to be intimate and naked with you just in the bedroom. I want to be intimate and naked with you spiritually and mentally and emotionally. And I want you to bring out the worst in me because I don't want it there anymore. Join with me as we close. Father, I thank you for the opportunities that you give us in life. I know there's some here this morning who have been down the road of marriage and are not married anymore. And Father, instead of looking back on that time with anger and bitterness, Father, help us see the ways that even in the way things ended, how it's given me an opportunity to become more like you. And Father, for those who are currently in a covenantal relationship, who have committed their lives to their marriage partner, may they just be thankful, Father, not frustrated. Father, may we look forward to the day that we will become more like you. And thank you for providing someone who knows me so well, has committed their life to me, and loves me enough not to leave me this way. Give me humility. In Jesus' name. We turn towards communion. I go back to this passage. And in this passage, it's all a metaphor about how Christ gave himself up. If you read there in verse 25, it says, and Christ gave himself up for us. And the whole idea is that you're supposed to look at the marriage relationship in the same way that Christ loved us. Our marriage relationship should mirror Christ's love for us. I thought to myself, what would it look like if Christ's love for us mirrored our relationships? What if Christ's love for us mirrored our marriage relationships, how we do marriage, how we find somebody to marry? It'd be Jesus up on the cross going, not my body type. No, I'm not doing this for you. We got good, I got some chemistry going on there. Yeah, I'll die for you. Hey, how you doing? Doing this for you, sweetie. And you're looking at me like, that's a little sacrilegious there, Steve. That's the point. Jesus didn't look out there for someone who was lovable and so lovely and beautiful that he had to spend the rest of his life for. He looked out and he saw nothing but those who were unlovely, unlovable. Even in the midst of it, in the current context, he's being spit upon, mocked, beaten. We haven't done much differently in the years since. He didn't get up there because you were lovable. He got up there to make you lovable. He didn't get up there because you were lovely. He got up there to make you lovely. So He says, I want to remind you of that. If you ever wonder that, you ever think that, you know, you're not good enough, you ever think you're not worthy, just know I didn't get up here because you were worthy. I didn't love you because you were perfect. I loved you to make you perfect. So when you come forward to tear off a piece of bread, you're just reminded, as unlovable as I am, Christ loved me anyway. So I want you this morning not just to tear off a piece of bread and think about what Christ did for you, but also ask yourself, in what way is he calling me to do this for someone else? God, I fully accept I'm not lovable, yet you made me lovable. First, God, the person I'm with, I see all the unlovely things in them. But Father, may I sacrifice myself to make them more lovely. We take off that piece of bread, we then dip it in the cup, which is the representative of his blood, which is shed for us at great cost, to wash us, to cleanse us, to make us pure. All that we might do that in our relationship. So I invite you to come. If you want to spend some time at the altar this morning to rededicate yourself or confess to God privately, you're welcome to do that. If you'd like to pray with the pastor, myself and Pastor James will be up here to pray with you. Maybe for some of you need to renew your commitment to him or maybe begin a relationship with God this morning. Come down the center aisles, return on the sides. I ask whatever God's put upon your heart to do, that you do business with him this morning. Will you come?
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.